In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Coolest Conversations podcast time, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. And this is the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is famed recording and mastering engineer and producer, Rodney Mills, who over the course of his 50-plus years career has garnered at least as many gold and platinum records, recording artists from the likes of James Brown to Lynyrd Skynyrd, and mastering artists from the likes of R.E.M. to Rage Against the Machine. Now, he's also mastered the new Woggle single, Nothing More to Say, except, of course, he'll have plenty to share with us in a moment. But first, we'll hear some of that Woggle song, and then I'll be back with Rodney for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
And today I'm honored to have as my guest Rodney Mills, who has a 50-plus years career as an award-winning sound and mastering engineer and also as a producer. It's a career that's had him work on artists ranging from gospel, country, R&B, rock, and everything in between. And that does include my own band, The Woggles. And Rodney mastered our current coolest song in the world, Nothing More to Say. How are you, Rodney?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing okay considering the chaos of the world. Are you and your family healthy in these COVID times?
We are. We have remained healthy, and I don't know whether that's because of our present environment down here in Florida. We have a home down in Fernandina Beach, Florida, and we've been down here for almost 4 months, man.
Wow. So normally you're in the master house, your studio's there in Duluth. When you mastered our most recent record, did you do that from down there in Florida?
No, I didn't. I think I was back home in Atlanta when I did that. I have that same equipment down here that I have back there. And so with just a couple of hard drives and a piece of two equipment, I can transition or go from one place to the other without any problems.
Oh, that's great.
But I think I did your new single up in Atlanta.
Well, I mentioned your career as an engineer and a producer, but you began as a musician, right?
Yes. Yeah, my original beginnings were really no training in music, very little bit. I maybe was in a chorus and at church and at the high school. But my cousin kind of propositioned me one day. He says, Rodney, Tommy, a friend of ours, Tommy and I are going to start a band, and we want you to be in it. And I told him, I said, Junior, what his nickname was. I said, Junior, I know two chords on a ukulele. And that's it. But he was kind of persistent, and it kind of changed my life. And over time and everything, music just came, you know, once I got in the band, it was pretty consuming. I slowly transitioned from there into recording, which were kind of was a hobby of mine. And I took up recording on my own with tape recorders and everything. And then in 1967, moved to Atlanta and started engineering at a little studio that the band started, the Bushmen started. And from there, we gave that up, but I started hanging out at another recording studio, Lefebvre Sound, and they wound up offering me a full-time job. And so I left playing in the band to become a full-time recording engineer.
Well, let me ask you some more about the days in the band. So you only knew two chords on the ukulele. Is that why they had you play bass?
That's why I had me play bass. You know, we started out, everybody was playing guitars, and even the drummer, he didn't have a drum set. He had bongos. You know, we were still kind of in the days where folk music and all that stuff and everything. But as more we got to playing and everything, it's kind of like, well, we need to think about switching over to drums, and okay, maybe we need bass player. And I got, you know, thinking about bass. I said, well, it's one string, one note at a time. I raised my hand. I said, I think I want to be the bass player. And I never deviated from that, Manfred.
Well, how old were you when the band formed?
I think I was somewhere around 14 or 15 years old.
All right. So, did you guys see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan? Is that what was the impetus? Okay, so that was it then.
Yeah, we started before the Beatles, and you know, we played a lot of instrumental music, some standard, you know, stuff. Beach Boys came out, and I was like, wow, we could all sing a little bit. So we naturally took on the Beach Boys stuff to do, and that was exciting and fun and stuff like that. But when the Beatles came out, I remember Tommy, rhythm guitar player, he came, had either Life magazine or Look magazine, one or the other, had a front page cover of the Beatles. And so it's kind of like we kind of fell into that hype and everything. So when they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show with at that time long hair and everything, it's kind of like, it was definitely a game changer for us. We immediately decided, you know, this is a band. This is a real band. Each one of these guys, everybody knows each one of these guys by their first name. And they all have individual personalities. But the Beatles, the band, is something we had not seen come to the forefront that much until then. So it was definitely an eye-opener for us, as well as millions and millions of people all over the world.
So you never played with the Beatles, but you did play with the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, we blew the Rolling Stones off stage one night. No, we opened up for the Rolling Stones in Statesboro, Georgia, Georgia Southern College, and we did really well. And we opened up and played our little set and everything. We got an encore. And when it came time for the Stones to come on, they'd kind of gotten introduced, I think, to Jack Daniels. This is the first time they'd come to America. So when they got on stage, I think we were a little inebriated.
Well, I think, I'm wondering if that's the story that's in Keith Richards' memoir. He talks about, you know, playing in South Georgia and having a cup of, I guess it was a Jack and Coke. And the officer behind the stage said, don't take that on stage, boy, pour that out.
Yeah.
And Keith Richards is like, it's just Coke. And the cop was like, you know, I'm not having any of that. Pour it out, you know, and actually pulled out his gun, you know, which was to convince Keith Richards. So you guys, as the Bushmen, had a couple of singles. And I was listening to Friends and Lovers Forever. It's out on Smash.
Right.
And I noticed, first, by the way, it's got this cool Hang On Sloopy feel to it. It was produced by Shelby Singleton. Yeah, first of all, how did you come to that song?
Well, I think Shelby Singleton came up with that song. We certainly didn't write that song, and I think either Shelby knew the writers. I think he knew the writers that wrote the song, and so the song was presented to us. That was still in that there's kind of like this transition period, you know, in the late 60s and everything, that or the mid 60s, late 60s, you know, there was the old school people like Shelby Singleton was used to just working with solo artists.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like the way he approached us was not really so much of the band as it was the lead singer and the singer of the song. As a matter of fact, the next song we didn't even play on. It was done up in Nashville, and our lead singer, Harry Aldrich, went up and sang the song without us even being there. So it was kind of like there was this thing, you know, they didn't really comprehend, you know, having a band play as themselves musician-wise. And after I got to engineering, there was still quite a bit of that. Believe me, there were times, though, that the band should not have played. but I think that that made a big, you know, impact on me that later on as I got to working with artists and bands and everything, it's like, that was really important to me that the band be totally inclusive in the recording
right.
of their music and everything, as opposed to hiring session musicians to come in and play, and they just kind of stand on the sideline.
Well, I'm currently reading this Peter Gwalnick biography of Sam Phillips, which I think is really good. And I'm at the part where he sells Son to Shelby Singleton, and Shelby, you know, at least in the book, comes across as a quite the character. What was he like to work with, and did you ever cross paths again with him years later when you were working as an engineer?
No, I did not directly come across him as years later and everything. But he was, yes, he was quite a character and everything. One of the main things they did, he did for the band was he bought us all tickets for Atlanta Speedway race one year, and we all went out to see that what is now NASCAR. Uh-huh. The race at Atlanta Speedway, and that was probably the little, we stood in the infield and just turned our heads for about 3 hours. It was my first and last time there. I mean, I love NASCAR racing now and watch it on TV. At least I could kind of keep up with who's in the lead and everything. But Shelby carried us all out there, and Johnny B, our manager, knew Shelby Singleton because Johnny was a radio guy, radio announcer, DJ, promoter, and all that kind of stuff. And so he and Shelby had a pretty good relationship, and I think that's how. Well, going back a little bit, Manfred, we won a Battle of the Bands contest in Atlanta, and the deal was that we get a record deal with Mercury Records, and so Shelby Singleton became a part of that.
Okay.
And later on, we had the little studio. The band had a little studio in Atlanta when we first moved up there. And Shelby, he allowed us to record an album, and he sent down another guy, and I can't remember his name, Billy something. And he kind of produced the album on us, which never came out.
So what I was going to ask is, what led you to forego the joys of working as a traveling musician for a career as an engineer? So you guys move up to Atlanta and you kind of have this little studio, and that developed into your passion for.
Well, yeah, to be honest with you, man, we got in that studio and it's kind of like, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be the engineer because I was the guy in the band. I bought a really nice tape recorder. Mm-hmm. I tried to record the bands during rehearsals, and I've even carried on the road and try to record. So I had that part of me already kind of in me. And so we got in the studio. I became the engineer there. And so we gave up the studio after about 8 months. It just wasn't economically feasible. And I started hanging out at Lefevre Sound in the hopes of trading out me just hanging out there and doing whatever they wanted me to do for some studio time that I could get the Bushmen in there and record at some point.
Yeah.
Well, in the process of doing that, it's kind of like it's the age-old story. I got to hanging out, and then Maurice Lefevre, who owned the studio, asked me to go, you know, change a microphone, do this, and he'd tell me about a session he had, and I would mic everything ahead of time, and I slowly got sounds on stuff before he would even come into the control room. Mm-hmm. So finally, he said, Rodney, I want to hire you as full-time engineer, and you're going to have to quit that band. And that was in 68, same year that Mary and I got married, and I said, well, you know, I've been in this band for 7 years, and I'm 22 years old. It seemed like if we were going to make it, we had already done it. So it's time to move on.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what I did. I made that transition.
So Lefevre Sound, you were working with all types of music genres from the get-go. Is that fair to say?
Every day, almost. It's kind of like the studio. The studio's booked up. In a week's time and everything, I've probably worked with probably 5 different genres of music. And it was everything from folk music to real over-the-top rock and roll to R&B, instrumental, jazz. So it was just not a hodgepodge, but it was just a plethora of different genres that he didn't have time to say, well, I don't really have any expertise in this kind of music. You just kind of jump in the middle of it, and hopefully it turns out well, and that's kind of like been my life story.
Well, is that when you recorded James Brown, when you were working at Lefevre?
Yes, I worked there full-time 68 and 69. James Brown, they booked the recording studio for us to do a single on him. Now, this single, I think it's the world's longest title. The title of the song is, I Don't Want Nobody to Give Me Nothing, I'll Open the Door and Get It Myself.
It's hard to fit that title on a 45 alongside all the times it's going to list James Brown's name on it.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I never paid that much attention, but later on, so wow. And I met James Brown's daughter and grandson a while back, and I told them about my experience with him. And it was quite an experience, because 2 years before that, Mary and I had seen James Brown live, and that was quite an experience also. And then two years later, to actually be in a recording studio with him and becoming a part of his recording. Didn't realize it that much then, but later on I realized, wow, 69 was a big year for me. I engineered a song by R&B band called The Winstons, and a song called Coloring Father, mm-hmm. which was R&B Song of the Year in 69. And I'd been engineering for a year.
A couple of years ago, the Woggles, we were working with you. We were mixing the Big Beat album at your place there in Duluth, Georgia.
Right.
And Jeff Walls, our guitarist, he was asking me about some 45s I had just picked up, older records. And I mentioned Lee Dorsey's Everything I Do Gonna Be Funky. And Jeff and I are sitting in the back of the control room, and you were there at the board, and I mentioned that song title, and you spun around in the captain's chair there, and you said, I'm on that record. And Jeff and I looked at each other like, what are you talking about? So that turns out that's your voice at the top of this Lee Dorsey song.
Unfortunately.
So Alan Toussaint produced that, and he wanted to put your voice at the top of the song. Why did he do that?
Well, what you did back then, you didn't have a real-time readout on the tape machines or anything. So what you would do is slate the tape right before the artists or the musicians would do a recording of the song or a pass of it. You would hit the talkback button, and it would put a low-frequency tone as well as what you said. And so I said, Everything I Do From Now On Going to Be Funky, take two. So when the band recorded that, the musicians recorded that game, we listened back to it. And so, of course, as time went on, we started doing overdubs on everything else out and kept listening to that thing. And he said, I'm going to use that on the beginning of the song. And it was kind of like, so he said, Rodney, why don't you go out in the studio and do it on a good microphone and everything. But it was kind of like everything else. It was freezing. I was not meant to be an actor or anything. It was awful. So he wound up using what was actually done on the session. So yes, it's still there.
Well, does that qualify as your only lead vocal part?
Pretty close. No, that doesn't. No, it's not my only lead vocal. Now, on the B side of Friends and Lovers, there's a song on the B side called You've Been With Him, and I do sing lead on that B side. That would be my only performance as a lead vocalist. But that the Lee Dorsey is good. I'll take that. I'll take that too.
So we mentioned 69 being a really big year for you. You were also engineer on Lynyrd Skynyrd's first album. In fact, you engineered all of them, didn't you?
No.
Okay.
No, I did everything on that first album. I did not engineer. And matter of fact, it was kind of like the other engineer at the studio, Bob Langford, was kind of the main guy on it, because I was involved with an Atlanta Rhythm Section record at the same time.
Okay.
So as the project went along, Skynyrd's project went along, there were times where I would go in and engineer and do overdubs. And there was one of the songs that I recorded, pretty much the main track. So I like to include my name in that, even though I was not the principal engineer on everything. I did contribute to several songs on that album. So yes, so that there on that album, I kind of worked on and everything, but then they wrote Sweet Home Alabama after they completed the recording of that album. And so they booked the studio to come back in, and I did engineer Sweet Home Alabama and for that, for the second album.
Yeah.
And the, that was the only song I worked on the second album. The third album, it's the Burt Reynolds Longest Yard movie. We did it just for the movie, too. What is the name of it? Manfred. Longest Yard. And it's the opening scene of the movie where Burt Reynolds is driving his Maserati, Citroen Maserati, and he goes over the bridge in the Saturday Night Special.
That's got to be
it. Saturday Night Special I recorded. Okay. That's not on the third album?
Yeah, it's the opening track, Saturday Night Special.
Yeah. And we recorded that, just that song. The band came in just to record Saturday Night Special for the movie. So I did that with them, and then I didn't do any more recording with them until they had started their, actually turned out to be their last studio album, Street Survivors. And then I participated in that album very much so.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a, kind of a career-changing time for me when I worked with them on that.
How so?
Okay. Tom Dowd was the producer of that album, which, you know, I was almost afraid to sit next to it.
Yeah, right. He's the Tom Dowd engineer, producer that worked with Atlantic and all these, I guess, '50s, right, with all these R&B
artists. Yeah, it was just awesome and intimidating a little bit and everything. But my involvement thing became because Kevin Elson, who worked for the Skinner, heard the recordings they had started down in Miami at Criteria Studios, and they asked Kevin Elson what he thought had sounded and everything. He said, "It doesn't sound good to me at all." He says, "You guys need to go back to Studio One in Doraville, Georgia, and where you started, and you need to go back there and work with Rodney Mills." And Kevin made a big deal out of made a safety of a couple of the songs, came up to Atlanta, and Artemus Pyle, the drummer, came with him. And so we overdubbed the drums at Studio One, you know, to show how much better the drums could sound and could contribute to the recording than what they were getting down in Miami. And so we did that, and overdubbed Artemus, made a rough mix of it. Kevin and Artemus flew back to Miami and played it for the band. And Ronnie Van Zandt and the band decided, we're going to stop what we're doing here and we're going to go back to Studio One. Luckily they did. And it was a career changing time for me.
As a career changing time, then you wound up working with more visible projects or bigger projects?
Well, at that time, first of all, it was a big album. It's an important album and everything for them and everything. And at the end of it, here's what made it career changing. For the first time in my career, at the end of that project, Ronnie Van Zandt sat down with me and said, "Rodney, I want to give you some money for working on this album and some points or percentage of album sales." And I'm like, I was flabbergasted. I was, what? Nobody's ever given me a $50 tip, you know, much less. If I didn't get percentage, say that right off. I didn't get percentage, but I did get money. And Ronnie gave me $1,000 a song that I'd worked on. And at that time, it was $8,000, Manfred. And it's kind of set a precedent on most, on all the Atlanta Rhythm Section albums. I was the engineer on all that stuff, but I never got a bonus or anything like that. So after that, all the Atlanta Rhythm Section projects, I did get bonuses and I did get paid extra to work on their album. And Street Survivors also got me basically the production job with 38 Special, and mainly because you got the Van Zandt brothers.
Right.
You got Ronnie, Donnie, and Johnny, and I've worked with all of them, but and to be honest with you, Jeff Carlisi with 38 Special was the driving force that got me involved with 38, and that turned out to be a very rewarding part of my career
as well. Yeah. Well, you mentioned a couple of times working with the Atlanta Rhythm Section, and I was wondering, did that come out, that relationship come out of having worked with the Classics Four earlier on in your career?
That came out of primarily the the rhythm section that were studio musicians for Buddy Bowie kind of consisted of players from the Classics Four, musicians that were in the Candymen, the backup band for Roy Orbison. So three of the guys came out of the Candymen, the lead singer Rodney Justo, drummer Robert Nix, and the keyboard player Dean Daughtry, all came from that one band. And J.R. Cobb, the co-writer with Buddy Bowie, all the hits ARS had, well, most of the hits, and all the Classics Four hits like Spooky, Stormy, and Traces of Love.
Yeah.
So J.R. became co-writer with Buddy, and J.R. left the Classics Four and just became a studio player, co-writer with Buddy, and later on was rhythm guitar player for the Atlanta Rhythm Section.
Well, you had all this success, you know, with the 38 Special and Atlanta Rhythm Section. You also did stuff later on with Greg Allman. Do you think your work, I mean, your work is pretty closely associated with Southern rock, don't you think?
Yes, mainly because during that time period, Southern rock, you know, kind of took off and was doing really well. And Studio One, where we're located in Doraville, is just kind of like, okay, once Skinner kind of took off and everything, all of a sudden we started doing bands. We started doing Southern rock, and Atlanta Rhythm Section was kind of perceived as being a Southern rock band, which was kind of like just rooted on the coattails of the Southern rock, even though ARS was not typical Southern rock band.
Yeah.
And then, of course, 38 Special perceived as being a Southern rock band, but they're really a pop rock and roll band.
Yeah.
And so, yes, so Greg Allman kind of comes in there because it's just kind of like in that same era. But, you know, there's other people I work with, too. You know, it's kind of like the Doobie Brothers were certainly not Southern rock, and I did a couple albums with them. And there was bands like out in California, Cruzados.
Well, I want to ask you about this because, so you're working with these, you know, the bands generally are associated with Southern rock stuff, and that goes through the 70s, and now you're in the 80s. When did you actually decide to try your hand as being a producer or get jobs as being a producer as opposed to...
Okay, so go back. Yeah, I understand. So we go back to the Street Survivors album with Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Right.
At the end of that, because... You know, I basically, towards the end of that album, Tom Dowd left the album and did not complete the album.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not a producer. So the band, we were in the studio, said, well, we need to keep recording. So it was just really like me and the band finished that record, along with Kevin Elson.
Oh.
And because of that, when the album came out, Manfred, you know, instead of it saying produced by...
Yeah.
By Tom, Tom wouldn't let his name be on the album because he didn't have final say-so of all the last recordings, mixing, or anything. So Tom Dowd did not allow his name to be put on it. So it wound up, special production credit, Rodney Mills. And so there was a little bit of that. And while we were recording Street Survivors, Jeff Carlisi with 38 Special came out to the studio because he was going to school at Georgia Tech at that time. So, but he knew all everybody in Skinner and everything. So he'd come out to the studio and hang out and everything. And 38 Special had actually, by the time it was all over and everything, 38 Special had recorded a couple albums. So when it came time to do their new album, Jeff, because of that time he spent out Studio One, he called me and said, asked me would I be interested in engineering their next album. And so I don't remember exactly the, situation of why I said, Jeff, I'd love to engineer it, and I'd also like to produce it. And I think he thought about that a little bit, and he thought that was a good idea. And so through a lot of hard work after that and everything, I got that was my first production job for a major label.
Okay.
It was 38 Special, Rocking Into the Night album.
Well, we're fans of the Cruzados here in the Underground Garage. We've got them. We play them. You produced both their albums. How did you work with... Well, you produced the first album in its entirety, and I know you worked with the second album, but I'm not exactly certain. How did you wind up working with those guys?
Well, I kind of got a manager along the way, and it's kind of like he keeps sending me stuff. You know, he said, listen to this, and see if there's anything you like and everything. And so finally got this thing of Cruzados, and it's kind of like, I didn't know anything about the band or anything like that, but I liked the music, the melodic sense of what they were, and they were a little bit different sounding as far as the their instrumentation, the sounds and guitars and stuff like that. It sounded great to me. And to be honest with you, Manfred, I got the gig. They called me on the phone, and we had a long conversation over the phone, and I got hired.
Great.
I never met them face to face until I showed up in California to start the record.
And well, you were living the life of a big time producer by that point.
Oh well, man, I'm telling you what, I was almost tri-county wide reputation. No, it was a cool thing, you know, to go out to California and sit down, and I guess I felt comfortable working with almost any band, you know, cause my beginnings were in a band, and I realized early on, you know, it's like, as far as the Bushman goes, I was kind of like the slow man in the band, but everybody kind of helped me and everything. And, and so I finally got to where I felt comfortable with it. And same way working with bands is all, I just felt comfortable sitting down with guitar players and them coming up with maybe a basic idea as far as an overdub, and me just kind of help develop that and give us suggestion here and there, and it just kind of went on from there. But Cruzados were a joy to work with. Stevie Hofstetter, guitar player, had this spaghetti western guitar sound that I just absolutely loved. Tito LaRiva, the lead singer and everything, he was, what a great guy. He's just a fun guy to be around, and very talented, and he's had a pretty good career too. Without Cruzados ever really becoming any kind of widespread success or anything, but
yeah, I should point out we play his Tito and Tarantula stuff here in the Underground Garage.
Oh yeah.
So that Cruzados album, the first one came out in '85. The following year, Guadalcanal Diary released Jamboree, and you worked on that. Is that when you met the late Woggles guitarist Jeff Walls?
It was. That's the first time, you know, we kind of like, I think we kind of talked about everything and decided we was going to go forward with this thing. And so I went over and talked with the band, and I think everything kind of seemed to hit it off pretty well, even though they were a very different style band than I'd worked with before. But still, it was guitar based.
Yeah.
So I felt pretty comfortable with that. I liked the songs, and Murray, the lead singer, I liked him. And Jeff, one of the first things straight away that I got from him, that Jeff kind of knew what kind of sound he wanted and kind of the style he wanted to play in and everything. So me as it's kind of like when we got together and started and we did that album and everything. And it's kind of, so I'd get Jeff in the control room with me, sitting with me next to the console, and he'd play his parts there and everything. And sometimes I want Jeff to play this real kind of pop sounding part and everything. And Jeff said, no, that's not what this is about. And so it was kind of like, I wouldn't say we butted heads, but we did, we just came from a little bit different perspective, both of us and everything. But, we worked well together. I enjoyed it, the whole process, and it was a very different kind of music for me to be involved in. But there again, I kind of felt, you fall back on that, what we talked about earlier, the beginnings of where I worked on so many different genres and of music in a week's time, that I've always felt like I can pretty much adapt and become a part of almost any music I hear. There are times when that's it's difficult, but I can do it. I can still do it. I still kind of like lend a part of myself to what I'm doing or involved in. And Jeff, you know, it was kind of like not a surprise, but when he called me later on to work on you guys stuff and everything. I said, wow, Jeff doesn't remember those times that we kind of argued a little bit about sound. and to be honest with you, the work that I did with the Woggles and you guys and everything, it was a total pleasure. And,
thanks, Rodney.
And it was you two guys sitting in the back of the room there and kind of me working on the sounds and everything. And it's kind of like, I said, well, okay, let them listen to what I've got now. And then generally, you know, I said, here it comes. They're not going to like it. Well, they like it. And so it's just become a very positive, very kind of a good time for Jeff to give me a call and say, Rodney, we got some more recordings we want you to be involved in. And so the whole thing's been great.
So when we began working with you, and, you know, that was through Jeff, and initially it was mastering, and then later mixing and mastering, and we've done some overdubs. When did you start making this transition to mastering?
I'd say the early 90s and everything, the kind of the rock and roll scene across America changed more to the West Coast kind of grunge music, and to be honest with you, I was not a huge fan of that genre of rock, and that was one thing. The other thing was that I got two daughters that they were both in high school at that time, and I found myself missing out on half the stuff that they were involved in, for me having, you know, to go to New Orleans to record a project, Miami or out on the West Coast and stuff like that. So constantly read stuff, and Mix Magazine came out and they had an article in there about a new piece of software that you could burn a CD that could you be used for a master. So I said to myself, I've been going to mastering for almost 20 years up in New York with the same guy, Bob Ludwig. And it seems to me like maybe I could do on a much smaller scale the same thing. And this allowed me to, and I also decided, okay, I'm going to try this. And so I'm just going to kind of fix me a place in my basement downstairs. And you got to remember, this was back in the early 90s. Pro Tools had not even really gotten started. Pro Tools, there was a thing called Sound Tools. Mm-hmm. And it was a stereo program. And so I just kind of like put it all together. Then Pro Tools, they decided that they were going to come out with Pro Tools, DigiDesign was. And a four-track version of it. So I said, well, that's the software I'm going to use. And they got this brand-new thing, Manfred, called Plug-In. I'm really. And then it's kind of like, wow. So that's what a concept. So I did it to start with. I invested some money and energy and time in trying to put a room together in my house in Atlanta. And it was kind of like, in your lifetime, you make a few good decisions. Some people make a lot of good decisions, but I made a few good decisions, and that was one of the best ones I did. It allowed me to stay at home and kind of have my work schedule around where I could participate in stuff that my daughters were involved in. And it was almost in the first month that I started it, I had a lot of people call me and were interested in getting stuff mastered, and it's kind of like, well, here again, I'm kind of going into an element I'm not totally familiar with, but I've been going to master. At least I know why it's done and how it's kind of done and everything. And so I didn't hesitate too much. So it was almost immediately turned out to be a good idea. There again, it did let me come back to my beginnings when I worked at LeFevre Sound. Every week in mastering, I would get stuff. Be like five different genres of music or six different genres of music. And it also introduced me to rap hip hop, which I'd not been a part of at all. And but even to this day, it's still the majority of the work I do is rap hip hop.
So I'm going to
weird for a guy did all these Southern rock and roll.
Well, right. Well, I'm going to ask you some about that in a moment, but the notion of, you going into mastering, and you said, you know, you were familiar with having gone to the mastering place up in New York and what it's for and its purpose. And could you explain to folks listening who may not be aware of the mastering process? Because, you know, generally, I think people know that musicians go into a studio and they may be familiar with the fact that there's going to be a producer and a sound engineer. But then, after that's recorded, there's this whole other process called mastering. Can you explain what the purpose of that is?
Mastering is kind of the final step. The process before then is, so to speak, a gathering of all the individual elements into making a recording, you know, whether it be drums, guitars, keyboards, vocals, background vocals. So you're involved in all these different parts. In the end, someone, either the engineer that recorded all that stuff or a mixer, they combine all those elements into a stereo mix. And the stereo mix is generally, it's just done to where you get the right blend, right individual sounds on the instruments and everything. But mastering kind of pulls all this stuff together a little bit more. Mastering is kind of like, I listen to something other, I start just kind of like immediately, like when that song's playing for just a few seconds and everything, I will sometimes just start switching, just trying some things I hear immediately. It jumps out of my ears. Maybe if I just dip this down a little bit, right, this frequency down a little bit, you know, that sounds better. It's not so strident sounding now. And it's kind of like I can add, it needs to sound a little bit heavier on the low end or low frequencies and everything. So it's several tools I've got that I can kind of nurse a song and make it sound a little better. My goal is not to change anything totally, because I think once people mix something, everybody's pretty happy with the mix.
Right.
My thing is just to kind of enhance what they have.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's an easy process of just kind of doing a couple things, nice, smooth the upper frequencies, maybe bring the whole level up to what it maybe level-wise contemporary to that same genre music everybody else in that same genre music is, because my overall levels fail as far as, say, how hot the mix is or the recording is and everything varies quite a bit from different genres of music. And so if I'm doing rap hip-hop, it's usually the most extreme pushing of the levels and trying to get everything kind of in your face, pretty much, to, you know, maybe acoustic music or music that needs to be really dynamic. And so it needs to have that, be able to breathe up and down and dynamically go up and down, and you retain that. But there's still some small things I can do. And it's a lot of times people say, what are you doing to the song right now? And it's kind of like, I'm not always conscious, Manfred, of that I've push this this frequency plus a half a dB at 3,000 cycles, and I'm bringing back this. I'm using a little bit more compression. It's just a massaging of the final mix and everything into something that cohesive and sounds like it. It just makes the whole thing sound a little bit more alive. And I know it's very hard to explain exactly what mastering is, because it. No two projects are always the same. So it, you have to be able to adjust your attitude, so to speak, and your hearing to kind of accommodate the type of music that's presented to me. And it's kind of a thing, if I didn't have all those years and years of recording and going to mastering, and I'd sit there and I'd go into Bob Ludwig, I'd say, Bob, I don't think this stuff sounds very good. And it was kind of like, but coming out of there, Manfred always thought, wow, I did a great job. And he just helped me. He just helped me. And it's kind of like part of mastering also is that, you know, you let somebody else listen to your music that's not been listening to it over and over and over 1,000 times.
Right.
Because sometimes I'll get something and I say, wow, the guitar is really over the top. People just get used to sometimes hearing it a certain way. So I will sometimes change things and kind of hold my breath and see what they think. And most of the time, you know, it turns out well.
And, well, again, this, you know, your early days at Lefebvre working with all these different genres really paid off, because then mastering, as you said, it put you back into working with all these genres. Don't you think that newer engineers are missing out by not working with a wide spectrum of different types of music?
Well, I think that, I think engineers, some engineers now work on various stuff, but I think a lot of engineers or producers, especially producers, they get pigeonholed into a certain type of sound.
Yeah.
And the process, the way they work and everything is kind of the same and everything. And I think to the, to a lot of engineers that they don't want to experiment with a whole lot of different kinds of music. It's like, you know, it's kind of like they want to do hard rock. They want to do country. They don't want to do jazz. Or they want to do jazz and they don't want to do anything else. And it's kind of like you meet musicians that just kind of, and engineers that kind of get themselves in a position. To be honest with you, what we're talking about, you know, is Rodney back in the Southern rock. It was kind of like, not that I tried to just work on Southern rock stuff. It's just that Southern rock became very popular.
Yeah.
And that was the most predominant thing that I've worked on. And after a while, I got a reputation for working on that genre of music. And I think that's the way it is nowadays. Even nowadays, you get locked in on doing a certain kind of stuff. And it's not bad. Don't take me wrong. But I think it's easier now to kind of stay in that mainframe because everything is so manipulated. And,
right.
And producers and engineers are able to do so many things to sound and stuff, you know. But to be honest with you, the clients I have, the stuff they send me is usually, it's all kind of within the same ballpark, the individual people that send me stuff.
Right.
Every now and then somebody, they will send me something that's, right near something that's pretty different, but it's still within the parameters of stuff I've done for them before. They mm-hmm. still are recording stuff with the same ears they did on almost every other thing. So it makes it pretty easy sometimes that I know if I'm getting a project from so-and-so, I know it's going to sound good. You know, instead of me wondering what it is or exactly what style it is, I just know them as far as their ears and the way they record, it's going to sound pretty good. It makes my job a little bit easier.
Well, over the years, the Woggles have mixed stuff and done overdubs at your studio I mentioned, and we've always had you master the stuff. Yeah. And the most recent single, Nothing More to Say, you mastered. And this is our first without Jeff, right. Passed away about just over a year ago. And in his place, we've got little Steven on the record. Now, have you ever worked with Steven?
No, I've known him by knowing him as a solo artist himself, and of course working with Bruce Springsteen and everything, and you kind of know in his kind of guitar sound and stuff like that. One of the things I did notice on the new single and everything that I thought was that kind of carried the Woggles into the future or whatever is it still contained the energy that I've always known you guys to have on all your recordings before. And that same kind of guitar edge, that I don't know where little Steven did that on purpose or not, but it was still kind of that edginess and the guitar sound and everything. And style-wise, it didn't throw me. It's like, oh, well, this sounds like a completely different band now. It did not sound that way. And your voice may have had something to do with that. I don't know.
Well, in fact, as it turns out, Dennis, who runs Wicked Cool Records for Steven, and Dennis is also Steven's producer on his radio show, had mentioned to me that Steven had made a point to go back and listen to our recordings because he wanted to honor that the spirit of Jeff. And I think, in fact, those two guys were very similar working in the studio.
Really?
You know, very hands-on guys, but at the same time, very, very positive, very encouraging. And Steven, just like Jeff, when we're doing the backing vocals and things, just right in the middle of it, contributing parts as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was a very, very similar thing. Having heard that new Woggles record, little Steven, he passed the audition, then, do you think?
Yeah, tell him he's hired.
Well,
he did a great job. I think y'all did a great job. But to me, you know, to have a situation like that, you know, when Skinner lost Ronnie Van Zant, Skinner and everything, it was very tough for them to even go on. And I think for you guys to persevere and to go on, I think is a great thing. And I think that recording or this new song and everything is very indicative of the Woggles, not, you know, trying to change the image of the sound
right.
of the Woggles.
Yeah, I think so. So the B-side to the Woggle single is a version of this Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil song, Sweet Freedom, that Darlene Love was the first to do back in 2015. But we, you know, the Woggle's version is first rock and roll version, and I'm going to play that in a moment. But it starts off with this drum beat, just a few, first few bars is just the drums at the top of the song, nothing else. And listening to that made me think about this drum break he recorded that has since been sampled many, many, many times. And you mentioned earlier, as we were talking about the Winstons hit with Color and Father, so the B-side of that, is that Amen Brother, the B-side of that?
It's Amen Brother, and to be honest with you, the drum break in Amen Brother, this instrumental song that they recorded as a B-side to Color and Father, was completely, the whole song was completely forgotten by me until a few years ago. A guy called me up and asked me if I was the engineer recording Color and Father, and I said I was, and he said, do you understand the significance of the B-side of that? I said, I don't, and I don't remember what the B-side was. And he proceeded to tell me, and he also set up an interview to come down to Atlanta, and he bought a CD with it had about 50 little cuts, 50 short cuts on there, or that break beat and on the B-side of the single and everything, Amen Break, has now become known as Amen Break. You could instantly recognize that beat and all these, that sample of that beat and all these different recordings and everything, and just how widespread that beat had been used, and later been said that it's the most sampled break beat in music history.
Well, right. I want to add in there, Straight Outta Compton from N.W.A. It's used in there. I think there's this Rob Bass, DJ Eazy-E tune, Keep It Going Now. It's in that. Now, I've read that Oasis have used it, so it's not just R&B rap people, but Oasis has used it. And also the theme to that TV show, the animated show Futurama, also has it in there as well. Yeah. That's what I've read.
It's in a lot of stuff. It's in major commercials on TV, countless number of ways. And to be honest with you, when that breakbeat was first started sampling, there was no royalties or any thought of that given to the original artist or the drummer that actually did the breakbeat. So G.C. Coleman, who was the drummer of one of the Winstons that played that beat and everything, he was given no recognition up until almost towards the end of his life, and he received very little money. I think did raise some money for him at one point, but that beat got sampled and it was just passed around, and it was actually sold, you know, by people that had no rights to sell it, but they licensed it, sell it, whatever, and everybody kind of claimed, you know, they had rights to the thing, and when only really the drummer who never got the on his passing and everything, he's gotten a lot of recognition. I just wish it had happened earlier.
Well, you work with all these hip-hop artists. Yeah. Has anybody ever come in and had that sample on there, and then you've said, by the way, I'm the guy that recorded that?
No, but I'm telling you, yes, they have come in the same, but there have been times, you know, they come in and they see me and they know the work I've done and everything, but I'll tell that story. And they're just, I said, you know, I've originally recorded this thing called the Amen Break. I engineered that back in 1969. They just can't believe it. That I was so hip before my time.
Right. Well, Rodney, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure.
Well, we're going to go out now on the B-side to the new Woggle single that you mastered. It's Sweet Freedom from the Woggles and Little Stevens Underground Garage.
I was guilty as I was here. Being a
Sweet Freedom. That's the B-side to my band The Woggles' latest single out on Wicked Cool Records. The recording features Little Steven as a guitarist and producer, and the song was written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. The recording was engineered by Jeff Sanoff and mastered by Rodney Mills. And thanks again to Rodney for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our segment. Now, the Empty Hearts are a current supergroup, and they feature Wally Palmer of the Romantics, Elliot Easton of the Cars, Andy Babiuk of the Chesterfield Kings, and Clem Burke of Blondie. And it's the latter, drummer Clem Burke, who will be my guest next week, and we'll discuss the Empty Hearts' upcoming album, as well as his days in Blondie, and the many other artists that he's worked with over the years. That's your next week's Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels.